Hello and welcome back to this conference. My name is Jai Bristow and I'm one of your hosts. And today I am so pleased to be welcoming back the wonderful Akilah Riley Richardson. Welcome, Akilah.
Hi, nice to be with you again.
Nice to have you back. So you're a relational healing facilitator, a couples therapist, and a certified clinical trauma professional. And so today we're going to be talking about anxiety. And to get us started, do you want to tell us a little bit about your views on anxiety diagnoses?
Yeah, I feel like anxiety diagnoses are kind of complicated. Yeah, in the sense that I believe that there is, like, physiologically, the experience of anxiety is real. Yeah, so all the things that accompany anxiety in terms of the changes in respiration, digestion, what goes on with the air, everything, I think all of the physiological components are real. But I feel that there's something kind of political in the diagnoses. Yeah, and we have to be very, very careful with that. So I don't want to say I'm never a person to want to throw out everything. I think two things can be true at the same time. I think something can be very helpful, and I think something can also be harmful. And I think when anxiety diagnoses are used to pathologize or to say that somebody is disordered or experiencing a disorder, that's where my discomfort begins. And I'm walking in cautiously because, like I said, I don't think it's all bad or all good. I think we just have to kind of be with the reality that in some cases, diagnosing people with anxiety is a political move. It's a power over move in some cases. Being able to tell somebody that what they are feeling is disordered, yeah, has a political power over element to it. And I find that could be particularly harmful. And because a lot of my work is with marginalized people, primarily right now at this stage, BIPOC and LGBTQI folks, I struggle when persons say that any of these communities or people in these communities are struggling with anxiety. I'm thinking that this is a normal physiological response to people's context. And so the word itself comes with so much in it, yeah, that can feel very uncomfortable for me at times. So I'm very cautious when I use it, and when I do use it, because there may be no other word to be able to use it. I think it's important to normalize it, especially for bodies that are structurally disempowered. Yeah.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And I think the word that most stuck out for me in what you just shared is context, right? And contextualizing. And like you say, it's very easy for everyone to see things through a certain lens and to pathologize and to categorize as a disorder. And if someone has a very wholesome, healthy life and has experienced a lot of anxiety with no context, with no reason, then I understand why there might be some concern around it. But as you rightfully say, when working with marginalized communities, there's a lot of reasons for it. There's a lot of context. It's a natural, normal response to a lot of what people experience and live through. And so I'm wondering if you want to share a little bit more about that.
Yeah, before I say more on that, I want to just go back to what you're saying. So even if somebody is living in an environment that appears to be safe, yeah, they probably have inherited certain predispositions because of what their ancestors have been through. Yeah. So I want to say that, if you are a survivor, if you have a parent who's a Holocaust survivor, for example, yeah, because research talks about that, yeah, you'd find that your stress profile would be different, yeah, and that you'd be more inclined to certain kinds of experiences affiliated with stress. So I want to say that even when people are in environments that seem to be very peaceful, they may have inherited certain things from their ancestors. Like genetically, there's research to show us that you can inherit these things, right? And so it even in those cases, I wouldn't want us to use the word disorder. When I think about systemic trauma in particular, yeah, like there's this thing I always say when I teach about systemic trauma. I say it's chronic, it's pervasive, it's socially based, yeah, it's unpredictable, it's disenfranchised. And those five central components would make it logical for anybody to have a heightened response or heightened activation in those spaces. Like chronic, it's always going on, always pervasive. It's everywhere, every context, every institution, the education system, the legal system, the judicial system, it's always there. And we think about the fact that it's largely disenfranchised and invisibilized. I think I want to just be here a little bit with this, yeah? That when we're experiencing something that other people do not see as valid, which makes it disenfranchised, when we're experiencing something that is largely invisibilized, meaning that it's happening, but you know, it sometimes it's hard to be able to detect. It's these small things that are happening, small forms of microaggression. Yeah. All of these things can result in you feeling more alone in the world. Yeah. And this sense of feeling so alone in the world can in it can increase your like your primal panic. Yeah. And so it makes sense then that a body that's holding all of this but has to hold it alone, yeah, and has to also deal with invalidation would be feeling very, very quote unquote anxious. Because in addition to having to deal with the trauma itself, you then have to deal with the other piece, which is the piece around being it being disenfranchised, the piece around not being heard. You know, one of the biggest things about trauma is that it isn't exactly what you're holding, but it's what you're holding in the absence of an empathetic witness. And I'm leaning here on the work of Peter Levine in that regard, that we all need somebody to hold us, yeah, when we're experiencing trauma. But with systemic trauma, sometimes it's so difficult to feel held, because the same context, the same environment that's violating you, yeah, the same environment that would not create space for you to be heard or for you to like, just experience any kind of what am I looking for? Redress, yeah, and all of these things can heighten the anxiety in the body.
I love the way that you've describing all of that because I think it's so important in the work that you're doing where you're naming so much of what isn't usually named, right? And you're naming all these parts that are usually so invisible and that people kind of know about but can't always put their finger on, and just normalizing some of what so many people experience on a day-to-day. And again, you talked about safety earlier, and I'm wondering if you'd like to say a little bit more about that relationship with safety.
Oh, I love that line. Our relationship with safety. You see, this is why I love these conversations, because things come up to me, and things come to me, sorry, when you all say these things, when you interview us, you brilliant interviewers, say these things. Our relationship with safety. You know, I safety is largely about threat reduction and protection. Yeah. And when there is quote unquote safety, it means that there's little to no threat around us, right? But that's so very different from safeness, yeah. That sometimes there can be no threat around us, but we are not feeling comfort within. We are not feeling protected, yeah. We are not feeling secure. And as you just said that, Jai, it clicked to me that maybe in our current definitions of safeness, one of the things we need to include is that safeness is about your relationship to safety. Yeah. So when you said that, my brain went ding, ding. Yeah, I think because some of us may be in quote unquote safety, but we're not feeling safe. So safeness is our relationship to safety. Sometimes the relationship is one where we are accurately perceiving that there's no safety, and consequently, there is no safeness in the body. And then sometimes, even when there is safety, there are things that have happened to us that are not allowing us to feel safe. And I feel that, you know, when working with systemic trauma, especially when working with people who hold power and privilege in the world, and them wanting to create safety for marginalized people, I think this is an important distinction that we need to have a conversation around, because you can do many things to try to create safety, but persons are not experiencing safeness. Yeah. And sometimes it has nothing to do with how quote unquote safe you're trying to create, make this space be. Am I making sense? Yeah.
And just to clarify, when you talk about the difference between safety and safeness, is it that safety is to do with your external environment and safeness is to do with your internal experience?
Yeah, that's how I understand it. I mean, others may say it differently. I mean, people de define things differently all the time. So I'm not, in no way am I trying to colonize the definition of safety or safeness. Yeah. But this is one understanding of it that I buy into. And I think when I'm thinking about what could help to create a sense of safeness for people is being in spaces where there is accountability. Yeah. Like I was doing some work with an organization recently, and I was leaning on a quote I had heard once, which says that if there are no brave spaces or safe spaces, they're only accountable spaces. Yeah. That is very, very difficult or even unfair, to be quite honest, to tell persons who've experienced systemic and historical trauma that you should feel safe here because I am trying to provide safety. Yeah. Or that you should feel brave here. Yeah. I think. But what I think might allow people to feel some semblance of that is accountability. A huge part of being able to create a world where marginalized people can feel less anxiety is by ensuring that your world is more and more accountable. Yeah, I think accountability is critical. Like in my work, I talk a lot about just the ways in which marginalized bodies have wired into them that nobody will listen. There will be no redress. There will be no one accountable. Yeah. And that's a theme, a relational theme living in the body. And I want us to think about how that relational theme of the fact that nobody will be accountable here, nobody, not when I'm harmed, nobody will be accountable, how that raises so much distress in the body. Yeah. So I just kind of, I'm happy that you named this piece around anxiety and the relationship to safety. Because we may be creating safe context, but because of a lack of accountability, people don't feel a sense of safeness.
That makes so much sense. And I'm wondering if you could just, for those who don't quite know what you mean by accountability, because again, that's another one of those words which can mean slightly different things to different people, right? So if you could give us your definition or an example to illustrate what you mean by that accountability that supports that safety.
Yeah, when I think about accountability, remember when I said that one of the things about systemic trauma is that it's disenfranchised. And it's disenfranchised for two reasons. People often don't believe that what you experience is real. And people also don't treat you as somebody that is worthy of being heard. And I want to add a third element. Now, things are emerging as we speak. I feel like disenfranchisement is also about the perpetrator as well, the power and privilege and the ways in which our society treats the perpetrator, right? So when I think about accountability exists in a context where we believe that the experience of the person who's been harmed is valid. We believe that the person who's harmed is a person worthy of being heard, and as for us stopping to hear and listen and to fully, be in the experience of that person. And we are willing, the third piece, we are willing to challenge ourselves to push past the ways in which power and privilege protects some people in our society, yeah, from being held accountable. We're willing to confront those things. We're willing to push back against those things, and we're able to pull those persons into spaces where they can answer for the ways in which they've created harm. And I want to say that harm has little to do with intention. Yeah. Like when people harm, they often want to talk about the fact that they didn't mean it. Yeah. There's a difference between what you meant and the consequence. And how can we create worlds where we can distinguish between those two? We can be with the person and accept that yes, you did not mean to harm, and communicate compassion and care there, and still know that there must be some kind of redress. Yeah, there must be some kind of protection for the person who has been harmed. And I want to say the reason why I think it needs to be some kind of redress or some kind of protection is because the harms that we commit often are as a result of subtle, unconsciously held beliefs about how the world works. Yeah. So it's not about intention. I want to share a story about I mean, it's not the nicest story to share in my opinion, but it's about my relationship with my own children, where there's a power differential. So this week, I notice it happens sometimes when I'm very tired. Yeah. Or if I'm frustrated with something and I'm communicating with them, that sometimes my tone with them can be a little bit short. I could be, yeah. I can be snappy. And I had this moment, Jai, when I said to myself, why is it that, Akila, why is it that you know, some parts of you know that you could be snappy here, but you can't do it in another context? Like you would not dare let this leak elsewhere. No, I consider myself to be relatively self-aware of power and that kind of thing. But yet still, there is some unconsciously held knowing in my body. Like I'm saying that I'm feeling tearful that says that this is a place where I can express displaced frustration or whatever. And even though I'm not consciously thinking about it, I do know that my body has learned something about power differentials. And so my body is abusing power. And I'm not intentionally doing it, Jai. I am not thinking I want to harm my children. No. But there's this unconsciously held belief. There's this thing, this felt sense that I've learned from the world. And it's allowing me to play this thing out here. So I had to pull them in. Recently, I had to say, you know what? Last week, I was snappy. And this is how I was behaving. And because I was really stressed. And you didn't deserve that from me. I had to be accountable. And so I want to bring that back to what we're speaking here about just the ways in which people who hold power and privilege in our world, people who hold, for example, white bodies in the global north, that sometimes there is no intention to harm people of color. But wired in you, just like wired in me as a parent, wired in you are often assumptions about how the world works that you are carrying from your own ancestors. Yeah. And you are understanding racial dynamics. Your body's understanding this in this unconscious way. And you have to be accountable. It does not matter if you intended, but you have to be accountable. So going back to all of this thing about accountability, it's being able to push past and do some really hard interrogation, some hard self-interrogation as well, to be able to create these kinds of accountable spaces. I know I said a lot. I hope I didn't get you lost there,
Not
but
at all. I think it's so important the pieces you're bringing in around the different power dynamics and how easy it is to fall into those dynamics, right? And that when you're the one who has the power, whether it's on a personal level, like a parent and children, or a more systemic level, like white people and people of color, that, in order to be accountability, it's like that example that you just gave. It's repairing, it's acknowledging, it's taking responsibility and learning and doing things differently. And I think that that's so important in conversations around safety and safeness and, these conversations around anxiety, which, as you talked about, is often the lack of that safety and safeness, which is also to do with the lack of accountability. So I really, really appreciate you bringing all of this in. And so I'm curious to as well, because, in your definition of it, and you were talking about the diagnoses and the pathologizing and how, it can be weaponized and how that's not particularly helpful. And so I'm wondering, what are some things that are more helpful? What are some ways that we can work with anxiety, rename anxiety, and offer it some more spaciousness, and move away from that harmful pathologizing?
yeah. As you know, I have an approach that I work with called PRIDE, PRIDE, which is Pivot, Rumble, Imagine, Develop, Evolve. And before I say more about this, I always have to give this disclaimer. I have no interest in model wars. I have no interest in having a model that is the model to heal. I'm not even trying to say that this is the way to work with anxiety. I think there's so much beauty out there, so many wonderful models, so many different ways. This is how I think about it, and people are welcome to disregard, keep, take pieces, whatever. And quite frankly, because of how my brain works, things are always evolving and changing. So what I'm saying now, after I've released it, might sound, I won't be saying the same thing in 2 years. I love the word you use, spaciousness, and I want to be with that word. And I want to thank you for teaching me as we talk, Jaya. You're really teaching me about how to think about the work more, or at least help me to see some things that I should have been seeing. Because the model for me is about spaciousness. And so only when you just said it, I was like, oh, that's what I'm trying to do. I'm trying to give us room. Room and space is that's one of the spoils of colonialism. Yeah. Room and space. Spoils of racism, room and space, spoils of homophobia, that we don't have room, Jai. And so, in sitting with people, I'm thinking about how can I create room for all of you? So, the P is about pivoting, helping you to not only look inside, but look outside and to see what is shaping this anxious experience. You know, what is feeding this? What are the structures around me? Yeah, that I've even internalized to some extent, that are feeding this, and the room to rumble, you know, to interrogate. Like I feel like when you're living in a marginalized body, you're so focused on surviving that there is no room to rumble and interrogate because you're so focused on surviving. And so I think when working with marginalized people, doing the R, giving them the space to rumble, to interrogate what is feeding their behavior, and to challenge it, and to ask themselves, whose imagination am I living in? You know, what have I privileged in my body? What have I not? Yeah, I think that's so important. And giving them space to understand and create new ways of being in the world. And when there are no opportunities to have, when there are no new ways that it could possibly be, because their systemic context is just so harmful, giving them the space to rename their experience. So I was working with a client recently, who was experiencing, like the client told me that they had been in therapy with her before, and they were told that they were emotionally repressed. And I was like, well, of course you're repressed. Like, this makes complete sense. How else can you survive biphobia? Because your client was bisexual. How else can you survive biphobia? You need to be repressed. And then what becomes necessary then is to rename the experience. Like, repressed is such a pathologizing term, in my opinion. How else can I name this? Or how else can I redefine what repressed means? So I'm thinking, I'm bringing it back here to anxiety, right? After we give people the space to understand what's feeding their anxiety, to interrogate it, then we give them the space to rename what they're experiencing. Do we want to call this anxiety? Do we want to call this something else? Yeah, give people that power to make sense of their reality. And renaming does not mean that we are discarding the old. We can hold both. Yeah, we can hold both, and we can seek different forms of treatment as a result. So if you want to engage in pharmacotherapy to deal with anxiety, that's fine. Yeah, I'm not trying to discredit or discard any of those things. What we're just trying to do is to give people room to see what's feeding their experiences, and give them the space to rename it, and then to create new ways of being with their anxiety. Yeah, I think your relationship to your anxiety is very, very important. I think being able to go into, I'm leaning here on some work from Dan Siegel, Julian Taylor Shaw, Deb Dana, etc. But being able to witness this anxiety with intense compassion, I think is so important. Intense compassion, intense kindness. And one of the things that I've realized is that sometimes we're trying to undo and unlearn, but sometimes we can't undo and unlearn. Sometimes we just have to grieve. This is the reality. And I have to trust that this anxiety is important. And I have to be with this anxiety from a place of grieving that I will never be able to feel safeness in my body. And therefore, I have to now develop skills, yeah, to be able to deal with the world and to deal with my anxiety. So I wanna, I'm very cautious when it comes to trying to help marginalized people to feel less anxious. In fact, I think sometimes that could be counterproductive. It could be anti-therapeutic. Like I was saying to a client of mine recently, I don't know if I want to I don't know if it's helpful for us to get rid of this anxiety. So we do all this work here and you leave here in this kumbaya state, but then you need your hypervigilance to be able to survive your world. You know, I had a client of mine recently, and the client has given me permission to use this quote. So I think it's so powerful. The client is a black man in the US. And when we were talking about the police system in the US and taxes, the client said, I feel like I'm paying them to kill me. And that line stood out to me forever, Jai. The people walking around feeling in their bodies that they are paying systems to kill them. And so when a client like that says to me, I'm feeling anxious, I don't know if I want to be doing any let's breathe and said to yourself, I'm thinking, damn, you need to be anxious. You, how else are you going to survive this? So I think it's about giving that spaciousness to people to rename and decide what is their relationship going to be like with anxiety. Do they want to welcome it, embrace it, and then what are these skills that they want to implement to be able to manage it so that they can also live? Because the thing is that living in an anxious state, living it does take away part of your living, your ability to live fully and freely in the world. Yeah. A lot of things that we purport to be healthy living and healthy, wholehearted living are features of privilege. Yeah. And I think I don't know, we feel as in a number in some ways there by saying that this is what mental health looks like and being able to be integrated. And what they haven't said is that those things are tied to occupying positions of privilege in the world. And how do we support persons who have to live in anxiety to also have some glimmer of what it feels like to be centered, to be fully immersed in experiences? How do we create those opportunities as well? And those things come from skills, but it's a long process and there is definitely no end, in sight.
Yeah, I'm really, really touched by everything you've just shared, and just again recognizing the reality, and the need for anxiety for a lot of people living in today's world. And you talked about compassion and kindness. And again, I think that it's a lot easier when we step away from pathologizing, when we recognize the need for anxiety and the importance that it actually plays, right? And that's what you're talking about. And we recognize the reality, then it's easier to have compassion and kindness. And that's why I'm so grateful for this conversation and for your work and for bringing this piece into the conference. Because I think it's something that, again, can be very easily overlooked. And the ways that you're talking about, like renaming and deciding and choosing what relationship one has with one's anxiety. So it's not about pushing it away or like necessarily embracing it fully. It's like that is an area where there is choice and autonomy in choosing what relationship is had with it. And then again, as you say, the importance of finding skills in which to live, and that everyone deserves to be grounded and centered, even whilst living in a very anxiety-inducing situations and in a very anxiety-inducing world. And so I'm wondering if we can go into some of those skills of how to develop some of those skills.
Yeah, I'm so glad that you raised that. So when I think about skill building, it depends on what is showing up for me in the room, right? So sometimes the skill work looks like being able to How to tend to oneself becomes a skill. I know this might sound weird, but just knowing how to tend to oneself when you're in a space that is actually safe, but you're not experiencing safeness. How do we teach people how to engage in self-tending, to practice self-compassion? You can lean on the work of I think it's Paul Gilbert and Dennis Tush looking at compassion-focused therapy. You can lean a bit on the work of Julianne Taylor Shaw, I think, as well, in the STAIR model. How do we teach people how to be kind to themselves and what the steps and the processes? So that's one. Boundary setting, I think, is also very important. Teaching people when it is safe. Ooh, and it just came up for me that I didn't realize before. Like, so in there are a lot of boundaries work out there. There are a lot of boundaries exercises out there. And in those exercises, we learn about, how to protect oneself mentally and also knowing when to contain, right? But something just came to me as we were speaking. I think also teaching people when to have those kinds of protective boundaries and when not to. So, for example, protective boundaries essentially are about having two things, discernment and acceptance, understanding that. Discernment is about understanding that what's happening outside of me does not impact me. Yeah, so being able to discern and acceptance is saying, you know what, it's okay for this thing to be happening outside of me. So that enables me to then have these kind of protective boundaries. What I'm realizing now as I'm talking about it is that we have to teach people not only how to practice boundary work, how to build mental and protective boundaries, but knowing when to and when not to. Because there are times when you have to, take in what's happening around you, because if you don't, you could be harmed. Yeah. So it's about discerning when to put on this boundary and to, protect oneself and knowing, okay, when do I have to pull this down? Because I know that I have to respond, right? So when I think about tending, I think about boundaries, I think about skills and grieving. I think that might sound weird, but being able to teach people how to grieve their realities without self-blame and self-victimization. Yeah. So there are some things that will never change. And that's kind of painful to say, but it's true. Yeah. And how do we teach people to be with grief differently? It's not these five stages and moving through. When you're grieving from a marginalized position, you're grieving, you're in a constant state of grief. And how do we teach people to work with grief and to be with grief? The other piece is around mindfulness and witnessing mind, teaching people how to track their bodies, to go into witnessing mind state, to look for sensations that are coming up that are attached to different activation states in their bodies. And the purpose of being able to do that is because when you get into a state of mindfulness, the body releases, the brain releases GABA, which allows you to regulate a little bit, right? So you want to teach people how to practice that kind of witnessing mind big bit. I want to say that in order for you to teach skills, when I say you being the therapist, your own relationship with like power, your own relationship with not knowing of and your own relationship with realizing that what people are experiencing makes sense is really important. And I'm leaning again on the work of Julianne Taylor Shaw here, because I think when we walk in with skills building as being an investment in a product, meaning that after I teach these skills, the client should be, I think we can be at risk of further harming people. Yeah. People need to take their time to develop the skills that are required for them given their context. When you're sitting with somebody in an artificial environment, like a therapeutic room, you are teaching things that people may be able to practice with you, but sometimes it can be very challenging to practice outside. So I think even the way that we teach skills, we have to kind of approach this from a very humble, egalitarian power with space, because the things we want people to be able to learn may be very difficult in the context that they occupy. Yeah.
No, thank you for all of that. And I think it's really important to bring in these skills and also recognize the difficulty of some of these skills, right? And so, what is it that you observe when people struggle to practice some of these?
It's so interesting. Can I say every time a question is asked here, another aha moment comes up for me? So I was thinking to myself, as you said the word skills, I was like, is that word skill or even a power over move, a power over word where we think, yeah, if for people to deal with anxiety, they need these skills. But then maybe what they're doing day by day in terms of surviving skills as well, Jay. And as you said it, my brain went, Nakilo, you need to rethink this. typically when we think about anxiety, we see things like find, the F's, right? Find, fix, flight, fight, freeze, right? And my body just said these are some big skills that people have, and they're typically not seen as, yeah, they're typically not seen as skills. But literally, I began to think about flight as a skill. So when people experiencing some kind of horror, yeah, one of the first things they want to do is just get away from it, especially when there's no accountability, there's no redress, there's no need to stop that. It's about how do I get away from this, flight. And then there's no redress, there is no body to soothe, there's no way to help the person go back to an integrated state. There is this increased horror and there's this rage to fight. And then, even when it begins to escalate, there you can see the person moves into this freeze, which is this interesting space between sympathetic nervous system and dorsal vagal system, this terror in the body that causes the person to freeze, this high toe immobility, right? And a lot of times when persons are harmed, you hear them talk about that, just being like, my body just froze, I didn't know what to do. I'm thinking of all these first three things as skills. The other thing I'm thinking of as a skill is when the body just realizes, you know what, I need to find a way to be able to manage this. So I'm looking, I'm finding, I'm finding, trying to find some way out. That finding reflex is also a skill. And then the fixing piece. I want to say that the fixing and the way that some of us fawn and try to regulate another person so that we can get safe. And I know there's this distinction between fawning and appeasing, and I encourage us to, if we can, look at the work of Linda Tsai, as Linda distinguishes between those two, fawning and appeasing. And I can't remember the distinction, to be quite honest, right now, but I know that with one of them, it's about, I need to feel safe. So what I'm going to do is to please you and please you and please you so that I could be safe. I'm going to tell you how wonderful you are. I'm going to work really hard, so that I can be safe. Or I'm going to hold back everything that I feel inside, just not to further offend you. And I'm seeing now with no equivocation that the ability to do that when experiencing harm that will not be seen, this harm will be disenfranchised. The ability of your nervous system to do that is a skill. I want to say that being able to appease, being able to fawn, being able to hold back so that you could keep yourself safe is a skill. And I think when we work with people, we need to help them to see how their body naturally has these skills. And I don't want to, I guess I'm dialing back because things are emerging as we speak. I know I presented some things of the skills we need to teach people. But now, as I'm seeing it now, Jai, I think the first thing we need to do is to honor the natural skills that people have for surviving. And then we could furnish them with some of these things, but in no way are these things better than what the body naturally does to take care of them.
I think that's beautiful, and I love the way that something that's often framed as trauma responses, the way you're talking about them as skills, because that's what they are, right? Survival skills. And
Yes.
I think again, framing it in that way supports the compassion and kindness that you were talking about earlier. And then the
Yeah.
skills we were talking about beforehand are skills you were teaching in order to be able to live and to manage
Yeah.
in this world, in this body, with this anxiety, in this society, in all of that. And yet to, again, it's what you were talking about before, you know, to have both and to be able
Both
to
acts.
honor those survival skills and also cultivate other skills so that we're coming out of survival mode and into sort of living mode. And and I love Akila, I love just how real you are with all your responses, you know, and then not offering a step-by-step, book by book. You're like, yeah, here's my model, take it or leave it, take what you want, what you don't want. Oh, here's something that's coming to me now. And it's so refreshing to just witness the ways in which you model what you speak about and the realness and authenticity that shines through as you share some of this.
Yeah, but I'm happy that I'm having this moment with you now where I could just be like, this is a skill, and we have to honor it as a skill, as opposed to an adaptation. This is a skill, yeah, that has kept people safe. And you know, for those of us who occupy BIPOC bodies in particular, we know that if our ancestors didn't have these skills, we wouldn't be here. They didn't know how to peas and fawn and this and that. They may have been killed and we wouldn't have been here. And I want to just honor these, how they've lived with anxiety and how they've taken care of themselves and us, and that they didn't need us or somebody. You know, they had their own trauma theories, trauma therapy. They were working it out. Yeah, they were working it out moment by moment. And yes, we're carrying a lot in our bodies, but we're also carrying some tools that they gave to us. That the field of psychotherapy is sometimes quite invested in pathologizing and wanting to put a diagnosis to. Like, I don't know in what world would we tell marginalized people that they should not know how to fawn and appease. Like, that's not our reality. I have had to learn how to fawn and appease. I have had to learn how to fawn and appease white bodies. And I say that with no shame. And it's not manipulative. It's not designed to get anything. It's a very, I can, I don't know, I don't know how to explain it. I've had some moments where I feel some conscious thing in my body that says, if you don't appease, there's harm coming your way. That you don't have the skills to deal with, and you don't even have, and I want to say this piece, you don't have the power here to be able to stop the harm or deal with the impact of the harm. You don't have the power. And that's where, when I talk about grieving as a skill, Jay, I talk about the fact that how do we teach people, I hear the word teach, how do we be with people in grieving in a different way that is outside the textbook, you know, with knowing that you can't move through this into any kind of acceptance, that you may be constantly uncomfortable with the fact that you will not have power here. Yeah. And I think each therapist, I don't have a template for this. I think each therapist has to search within and figure out, okay, how do I support this grief, understanding the context and understanding that this thing may not, will not, cannot shift or change.
100%. And I'm really struck and touched by everything you're sharing and you know, connecting to things in my own personal experience as well. Because I think that again, what you're talking about, the issues with pathologizing and diagnosing as disorder, is that there's a lot of judgment in that, right? And that often the having hosted a lot of trauma summits now and a lot of these conferences, I understand that often when people talk about that, it's the idea of it's the belief that there is safety. It's like come out of your trauma responses because you're actually in safety. Those trauma responses help you survive when you're in danger, but most of the time you're not, and you need to teach your body and your system that you're not. But as you've rightfully mentioned earlier, for people in marginalized bodies, most of the time there is not that safety. And even if there is that safety, there's probably not that safeness. And so then we need those survival skills in a way that other people might not. And I, again, have used fawning to get me out of some really nasty situations that I won't go into in this conversation. But I think, yeah, like the way that you're honoring that instead of dismissing, pathologizing, saying that that is not how we should feel, or we should be able to get rid of that or evolve from that, or whatever the language is so important to recognize.
Yeah, I don't have anything else to add, but yeah.
Akila, unfortunately, we're coming to an end now. Is there anything you would like to add before we finish?
Man, I don't even know what to say besides. I'm grateful for every survival strategy that sits in the body of marginalized people. I'm also sorry for the times when earlier in my training when I pathologized it, when I fell into white body psychotherapy, and now I am sitting with a recognition of how much people need to fawn and appease and fix and find and run and just celebrating that as some beautiful skills that we all need to learn. And that the client could become the teacher.
Absolutely. And you know, the story you gave earlier, the quote from one of your clients about paying the system to kill them, like that's a really good example of a time where fawning and appeasing.
Oh God, yeah.
Right? And so again, as you say, it's so important. Akila, for those who don't want to be pathologized and would like to work with you, how can they find out more about you and your work?
If you want to, you can Google me, Akilah Riley Richardson, not Akilah Riley Richardson. I do have a website, and on the website there's a way to contact me, or you can send me an email at info@akilahrileyrichardson.com. But yeah, once you go on the website, pretty easy to just kind of follow. You could subscribe, you can, yeah, and let's get into conversations where we, co-changing the world.
Fantastic. Thank you so much for your time and for this wonderful conversation. I really appreciate it, and I really appreciate you.
I appreciate you too. Thanks for having me.